Welcome to Justice Visions, the podcast about everything that is new in the domain of transitional justice. Justice Visions is hosted at the Human Rights Center of Ghent University. For more information, visit justicevisions.org.
Hi, Brigitte, how are you? I guess that you are all up for our conversation.
Yeah, hi, Artino. I'm very excited indeed. It was really nice to discuss criminal prosecutions the last time, but I'm quite thrilled to address another aspect of justice efforts for Syrians, which is truth-seeking.
And unfortunately, the issue is quite topical. As we launched our previous episode on criminal accountability, news came out about a massacre around 300 civilians in Al-Tadamon neighborhood of Damascus. This occurred already back in 2013, but it was only revealed now as war crime researchers managed, after years of work, to trick Assad intelligence officers into confessing the crime.
Yes, it is a terrible story that underscores yet again how painstaking and necessary documentation efforts and truth-seeking more broadly are. And it also goes back to the past violence, such as the Hama massacre in 1982, when the Assad regime killed between 30,000 and 40,000 civilians and 17,000 other people went missing.
True. The memory of this massacre and the taboo to raise it in public continues to haunt us as Assyrians. It also reinforced our determination to establish the truth and never to give up, because we need to know what happened to the victims. We need to resist to ensure that these crimes won't be erased.
Yeah, and this is also one of the central lines of my research, the potential of art to overcome exactly that erasure. And I find it daunting to consider how Syrians have been forced into silence, how crimes have been covered up, and they continue to be covered up today. And many of the justice efforts and artistic practices that I look into center around this determination to forbid forgetting. And that's why informal truth practices are really crucial, because an official truth commission, for example, is not available in the Syrian context.
So today we will shed the light on some of these informal truth practices and the potential of art to foreground truth claims. You have spoken to Syrian playwright Mohammed Al-Attar and civil society activist Leila Al-Kiki, right?
Yeah, indeed. And these were wonderful conversations. And before we address the conversations and also the imagination and how that helps to open up new avenues for victims, we will look into forensic and factual truth efforts. And you have spoken to Sima Nassar, who is a human rights defender and a researcher.
Sima has been documenting violations related to arbitrary arrest and enforced disappearance since 2011, focusing especially on the impact on women and children. She's active, among other, in civil society organizations and is also connected to the London School of Economics. She insists on how important the need of to be informed, the right to truth is.
Since the focus of my current work is on the issue of enforced disappearance in Syria, the search for truth is very important. It's more than just a word or one of the transitional justice measures to repair Syrian society. It means bringing justice to the victims, bringing justice to their families, to have the right to know the fate of their loved ones who disappeared and everything related to the circumstances in which they disappeared. Everything related to this violation.
It's really hard to imagine this tragedy with more than 150,000 persons who have been disappeared by the Syrian regime or kidnapped by one of the non-state actors such as the Islamic State. And many of them are still detained and have been killed, yet their fate remains unknown. As Victim Groups argues, this is one of the most important files that affects hundreds of thousands of Syrians. And Sima underscores the need to address this problem.
In post-revolution times, and during conflict times, especially when it's a protracted armed conflict, it's complicated because people don't know the fate of many of their loved ones and what happened to them. And this is one of their basic rights. In Syria, the issue is complicated, as there are many parties to the conflict. And as these parties have successively taken control in one particular area, which has made the problem of the missing and the disappeared largely unresolved. So demanding to know the truth is crucial.
She also insists on how this problem affects the families of disappeared and the missing, turning their lives into a hell. In their quest of searching for answers, many of them are furthermore subjected to financial and sexual extortion. Until family members obtain information about their beloved ones, their lives comes to a halt.
In my work with the families of the disappeared, especially women, whenever you ask anyone what they want, after 10 years, one answer always returns. We want to know what happened. What is the fate of my son or daughter? Even if this truth will be painful and the end is going to be bad, what they need to have access to this knowledge and this information, then we can talk of different ways of achieving justice for them and for their beloved ones. Whether if they want to pursue accountability or if this truth satisfies them and they can reconcile with it one way or another, or even if they want to find compensation. But the first step before anything is knowing the truth.
Here Seema zooms in on the case of the Douma 4 to make that point clearly. In 2013, four Syrian human rights defenders, namely Samira Al-Khalil, Razan Zaytouni, Wa'il Hamada, and Nazim Hamadi, were kidnapped in Douma. That's in eastern Ghouta, and they have not been seen since.
What happened in Douma after the forced displacement in 2018, when Jaish al-Islam moved to the north of Syria and abroad? We all know about the four activists, including Razan Zaytouni, who were disappeared in Douma, and that Jaish al-Islam was responsible for kidnapping them. When civilians from Ghouta were displaced, we lost the track of their fate, especially when the regime returned and took control of the area. It's uncertain what happened to these four, as it was assumed that the truth should have been revealed. This illustrates the loss of this information that many families, loved ones, and friends suffer from, not knowing the truth, and in which it complicates the process of searching for disappeared and achieved justice.
Apart from being deprived of news about their loved ones, Syrians are also deprived of accurate information. As Seema highlights, even when the regime provides information, this cannot be trusted and it cannot serve the purposes of truth seeking, to be honest.
As we can't trust any information obtained currently, therefore, searching for the truth is essential. We also saw in 2018, when the Syrian government began issuing death certificates for people who had disappeared. At that time, this became a way for families to know the fate of their beloved ones, as they went to request a family statement, just so they would know if their beloved one passed away or not. This is also an additional violation. However, even families who received a death certificate or any paper from the government on this subject, unfortunately, can't trust the veracity of these documents and these data.
This is really pernicious because the regime thinks it can get away with these forged death certificates and thus escape impunity. And in this respect, Seema raises the amnesty that was issued in April 2022 for so-called terrorist crimes. And this announcement was followed by the release of a very limited number of detainees, but it also entailed chaos and false hopes for families who wished to be reunited with their loved ones.
And as we saw recently, after the Syrian government issued a general amnesty, many families went out to the streets to see the released prisoners, to ask them if they have seen or know any information about their loved ones. You understand how desperate these families are, because there's no proof that their loved ones actually died. There's nobody. There's nothing to prove what happened. The death certificate and the report, which is not even a medical report, but just a piece of paper that states the person has died, without details on the cause of death. This doesn't prove anything. There's no evidence to prove the cause of death. nor how the death occurred. This is not enough information for the families to stop their search. And this was really inhumane, to see all these families in the streets waiting for any news, any information about their beloved ones, whether they died or whether they're still in prison.
The process of tracing a prisoner's journey is really stressful and inhumane, really. When people have been arrested or disappeared, for example, their families need to find out if they were transferred to a military police or submitted reports, but often to no avail, of course. And as Seema explains in her talk, if people find out where their loved one is, they can hardly even visit that person, unfortunately.
And the detainee's family can visit him in prison. This often happens after the prisoner is subjected to a military field court and is sentenced to death. By chance, the parents know that it's possible to visit him, so they go to visit him the first time. But when they go the second time, the sentence has been executed and their son has been executed. So he disappears again. The problem is that the families are not informed if the sentence was executed or if he died for another reason. And no one will be able to convince the families that their son has disappeared forever. No one will be convinced of that. When he disappeared for the first time and then they found him, they believe that he has disappeared the second time. And this means that they will search again for him in the hope that they will find him again. This is what I consider a complex violation, and unfortunately the families are subjected to this circle of devastation and fake hope.
This is really much more than a complex violation. It is really the pinnacle of cruelty. And at the end of the conversation you had with Seema, she also addresses the sensitivity of her work. She wants to enable closure for families. Yet in the absence of clarity and strong evidence of the claims, it is often impossible to realize.
There are a lot of things we can't tell people. There may be information from a former detainee who may tell us about a detainee that he was with in the cell and died while lying in his lap, for example, or that he was a witness to the death of a detainee. So this witness is 100% certain, but nevertheless, in many cases, families would not accept such a fact. But in our work, we can distinguish these details and events because we work in a chronological documentation. But in general, families and people who are released don't have this accuracy in verification and can't verify the information in detail as we do in our work. Therefore, we urgently need to have the truth, which is an urgent need for all the families to reach any information about their loved ones.
In my opinion, Seema nicely showed what truth-seeking means in the Syria context, how essential it is to make justice possible one day.
Yeah, and it also relates to what Maria Al-Abde and Veronica Bellintani said about the need to go beyond persecutions, because victim groups and civil society are really pushing for new ways to connect justice efforts increasingly to the grassroots level and also to the needs of victims.
And this push for innovation is the topic of the conversation you had with Leila Kiki, the director of the Syria campaign. Let's listen to that.
Hello, Leila. Nice to have you here with us for the Justice Visions Impunity Watch podcast. You are the director of the Syria campaign, which is an organization which is very well known in the field of human rights efforts and also creative efforts for Syrians. Can you give us some background on what you're doing exactly as a Syria campaign?
Hi, Birgit. Thank you for hosting me and giving me an opportunity to reflect on an issue that's very dear to my heart. As you said, we're a human rights organization that works to support Syria's heroes in everyday struggle for freedom, justice, and democracy.
Yeah, and how do you do that concretely? Because, of course, the Syria campaign, I know it very much as a campaigning organization, human rights organization, but the creative element is very intimately connected to the work you're doing.
Yeah, actually, we try to combine the best elements of campaigning, communications, digital mobilization, storytelling, teaming up with filmmakers, artists, to make sure that the story of human rights in Syria is alive and continues to be covered by the media as well.
And before we get into the details of the creative efforts, I just wanted to maybe zoom out on the justice efforts. How do you think of truth-seeking with regard to other justice efforts that are taking place in the Syrian context?
Actually, as a Syrian woman myself, someone who grew up, lived and worked in Damascus, who knew very well that how dangerous it was to even ask about the past, let alone be active in the community, I believe truth-seeking is a very important element of the root and the general work around justice and accountability. Since 2011, since we took to the streets ourselves, like we were faced not only by violence by the regime of Assad, but also by disinformation. That's where my belief in truth seeking is rooted.
What really strikes me in the Syrian context is that the quest for the truth is a really difficult one. There's, of course, blurring of truths like in all conflicts. But the narrative warfare by the Syrian regime and also by Russia has a big impact on the campaigns that you're doing, of course, with regard to the fate of detainees and other human rights related issues. How do you see that impact of disinformation concretely?
Oh, this is really like interesting to ask, because as I said, growing up in Syria, I knew how authoritarian regime and dictatorship mainly men write history. And that continued with the world of social media, this rapid digital nature of the conflict in Syria. There have been a lot of effort, not only to distort the history, but also the present, which makes me want to mention one story. When we were going out to protest in Damascus, the regime said the Syrians are going out because they are waiting for, or like thanking God for the rain. So even the present was being distorted. And the Russian-backed disinformation campaigns actually penetrates our lives. It's happening today, whether with COVID or with Ukraine, but for the past couple of years, or probably a decade, it was impacting the lives of Syrians, and especially those who fought and documented human rights violations.
Yes, it's quite stunning to see the contrast with regard to truth-seeking and the general interest for justice in Syria and Ukraine. But that's a different story. What I wanted to ask you is, what potential arts have for truth-seeking in your view?
It is very important to note that, especially maybe linking from the experience that we've lived as Syrians, there have been massive amount of crimes committed against men and women. We are talking about millions who've been impacted by the conflict in Syria. An example is the issue of detention and disappearance. Actually, the experiences of the detainees or their families are not homogeneous. You know, they vary and they are impacted by different factors such as gender, such as social background, such as, economic status. And I believe that only with art and culture, we can reflect on those diverse experiences of the survivors and victims. And this is what led us, most importantly, in my opinion, to think of teaming up with the world of culture, the world of cinema, the world of documentary, celebrities, because specific or traditional human rights documentation, no matter how the effort, and it's definitely important effort, cannot reflect on this diversity of experiences that Syrian men and women have lived.
Yeah, absolutely. And an image that comes to mind for me is really the Freedom Bus by the Families for Freedom. Could you maybe elaborate on the importance of the bus and also how you got the idea of linking that image to the campaign you're waging?
The Freedom Bus was created because families of those detainees wanted to transport their loved ones from Assad's dungeons and other underground jails in Syria to parliaments and capitals around the world. So we've teamed up with mothers, sisters, parents of the missing and made the bus in order to make the absence of their relatives visible to the world of power. But honestly, the bus became also a symbol of comfort to many Syrians. It suddenly became a place for physical gathering of Syrians in the diaspora, not only for the 100,000 families who have loved ones disappeared in Syria, but also for the community itself, the movement for justice in Syria. So we did not have our Tahrir Square. We don't have our Plaza del Mayo Square as well. So as Syrians, like, the bus became somehow like our square, but it is a mobile, creative installation art piece that moves around from one place to another and provides an opportunity for Syrians to stand next to it or put the photo of their loved ones on it and say, we are part of the, you know, justice movement in Syria.
And do you feel that through the Freedom Bus and also other campaigns, for example, you had the phones, the people who are still waiting for a phone call by their beloved ones who are missing and detained. Do you feel that you are able to presence their experiences and also their personal stories better through these artistic creative efforts?
I think personal stories are important in every model, in every form. They are who we are, they are where the future comes from, and they build the future. That said, when we especially work with, as I said, diverse issues, when we work with different audiences, the use of art and culture and creativity helps in highlighting some of the most horrific elements of the stories. So if we can talk about, you mentioned the stunt or the art installation we did around the issue of the missing, the right to know. It comes from the personal stories of Syrian mothers and families that we have been listening to at the Syria campaign. It comes from the fact that once I was interviewing a mother who refused to be displaced because she thought that her son will never remember the phone number of the mobile number of her, but will remember the landline. So the whole idea came or was inspired by this interview we were doing. And we said, how many women and mothers and brothers and fathers are waiting for that phone call that will tell them one piece of information about their loved ones? So we brought as much as possible, like land phones, like the old fashioned ones, and we placed them in that square in an attempt to show the scale, but also the diversity, different types, and like the agony of waiting for like one phone call in an age where we're all on our phones. But they are waiting for that phone call that will give them one piece of information about their loved ones.
That's a beautiful image. And I think it's one of the most poignant ones that I saw. I wanted to ask you as a last question about disappearing behind the sun. I was just listening to your podcast this morning, where you beautifully approached the story of Syria's missing and detained, and also the story of the survivors of the Hell of Saydnaya and their prison experiences. Could you elaborate on why you're investing in these kind of creative efforts?
Thank you, Bridget, for asking about Behind the Sun as well. And I encourage your listeners to tune in and listen to the story. The world of podcast is an important world for us because it also tells stories. And we believe our approach is storytelling. So Behind the Sun for me is a very important piece of documentation per se. It could be like what we refer to in organizations and oral history archive documentation. But the most important element of it is that in a creative way, it tells the story of friendship that was created out of the agony of two detainees who life brought them together in one of the most notorious prisons in Syria. The torture elements is there, the lack of basic livelihood conditions is there, but what matters is how come those two young men who grew up in Assad's dungeons have created this amazing solidarity that then extended behind their own friendship, but also to their one to his father and the other to his daughter. And the story is narrated by a young Syrian woman who just turned 20.
That's beautiful. And the young woman, by the way, is also the daughter, for our listeners, of Najah al-Bukay, one of the famous Syrian artists, painters who did wonderful artwork and tragic artwork on the Saidnaya prison. So I think to finish the circle of our conversation about truth-seeking, it also shows how art is really underlying so much of the work that you're doing.
Thank you, Brigitte.
And all the best with the future campaigns. We're looking forward to more of your creative efforts to shed light on what's happening in Syria and also to shed light, I think, on the agency of victim organizations, because that's really central in your work as well.
Thank you. It makes a lot to us to hear that from you.
That was amazing. What struck me also that Layla demonstrates how strong and active the Syrian diaspora is. We should not forget that most Syrian civil society activists, myself included, were forced into exile. Yet we continue to promote concrete justice efforts to create a new opportunities to mobilize for truth seeking.
Yeah, and I also find it fascinating how many people are involved in this. They might not always identify as justice actors, but there are many artists who are also engaged in truth-seeking. And this is why I wanted to talk to Mohammed Al-Attar, a Syrian playwright who currently resides in Berlin and who has written several plays that relate to our subject.
Hi, thank you for hosting me. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Yes, it's a crucial question, actually. Personally, the whole debate and the whole thing about justice became very present, and I have to say, in the last 2 years. Of course, as you know, justice was one of the key words and key terms that people across the Arab world, not just in Syria, like chanted for. The uprisings, the revolutions, the Thawrat, chanted for freedom, dignity, and justice, or social justice. The dream of change was violently crushed, oppressed by the regime and its backers, and by also many counter-revolutionary forces, especially the radical Islamists and also their backers. So what remained for us, I think, it's few fields where I think the battle is still on. One of them is definitely justice and accountability. We can speak also about narrative, writing history, trying to make sure that our version of the story is not erased. And I think this is linked to justice. I think there are now more and more clear efforts, actually, to figure out how we can proceed with accountability, even with the current difficult situation. For me, I think it became also an urgency to reflect on this from the artistic point of view, using an artistic tools maybe to reflect on the legal process that start to happen, especially in the diaspora, in the exile, in Europe.
And when you talk about reflecting also as an artist on truth-seeking and also your possible contribution to that, I emphasize possible because, of course, it is a very delicate enterprise also as an artist to see what your role could be. Could you maybe reflect a bit on how you view that delicate balance?
I know from the beginning that I have to approach the topic in a different way because contrary maybe to the work of lawyers, of human rights activists, of scholars, law scholars or other scholars, I have the freedom to imagine situations. Maybe I can liberate myself from the boundaries of the facts. And this is where art, I think, can contribute. I think it's kind of a parallel process or parallel reflection or parallel examination to this complicated topic. In theater, because this is my work, this is my field, I can combine documentary with fiction. So you start with real references, with the real protagonist, but then also have the capacity to imagine situations, to jump into the future, or to even dig into the past, where you are, again, free from the limitation of the facts and what is precisely truth and what is not.
Well, they say that art can be truer than truth, and a lot of your work also deals, of course, with that complexity. And I was just thinking, as the case of Lafargue is also a case, the cement factory that continued to operate in Syria in 2013-14 and contributed also to the financement of IS, that is also approached in your play, The Factory. We heard that the judicial process against Lafarc will be continued. I was wondering how, when you talk about facts and imagination and reality, what are your first thoughts on this evolution? And why also did you want to focus on Lafarc in the factory?
I think for me, the case of Lafarge factory in Syria was exemplary case to see how the role of foreign agents is big in any war zone, not just in Syria, but particularly in Syria. And also for me personally, the role of money or of investments of multinationals, of this big, big multinationals also in war zones. So for me, the struggle of Syria, in my opinion, is not just a classic case of a proxy war, but it's also an outcome of degradation in international politics. So for me, this case was a good to examine this in details. It was in reality under investigation in France, thanks to amazing efforts by a group of independent lawyers and people who devoted for this cause. And I think because you mentioned the play, it's for me, I felt really very happy yesterday, because in the play that we started working on in 2018, we didn't wait for the court process to unfold, because we knew it's a long pattern, and we knew that Lafarge, they are equipped with an arsenal of strong lawyers and law firms and everything. But in the play, we kind of put them in a kind of a court, metaphorically speaking, of course. And we tried to create this debate, by the way, even giving them the chance to present their argument. Again, I'm speaking on the metaphorical level. So in 2019, actually, we jumped to a future where now is more or less realizing. We kind of reach a conclusion where we put Lafarge in a corner of clear condemnation or complicity of war crimes. And now in the legal process, it's now unfolded. So yeah, I it gives me happiness to see that work of lawyers and work of artists, how they can complement each other.
Maybe to finish about the complementary role of art, one of the very difficult issues about the Syrian conflict, of course, is truth-seeking because of the narrative warfare that's waged, among others, by Russia and the Syrian regime, and it has led to a climate of uncertainty. And here artistic practices, of course, have an important role to play. How do you envisage this important role and also the complementary role of artistic practices? Could this be taken further to fight that narrative warfare, or to fight at least that kind of climate of uncertainty? If at all, it should be fighting.
Similar to what I said about maybe parallel reflection on the topic of justice and accountability, I think it goes the same if I say that theater and art is also a parallel way of writing the history and creating the narrative. There is the work of historians, people who document, the scholars, of course, people who maybe more or less through their work fix an official narrative. But I think, and this is not something now new, I'm not coming with anything new at all. I think since we knew literature or art, it was always a parallel archive of history. I like to believe that theater leaves a special impact and a special kind of memory with the receivers or with the audience. The other thing is, I think in the situation like in Syria, where the tragedy is still ongoing, where there is no, unfortunately, a clear end for this agony, you know, I think you need also to create spaces where you can discuss these difficult topics with more ease, with more freedom, with less tension, with less polarization. And I think this is also something I personally think it's what we can do through art. Because if you look about, just as an example, the discussions around the last trial in Koblenz, you see how it was sometimes really polarized people and created tension, even among people who are sharing the same political affiliation. I think in art you can move this discussion, not undermining it. So I use the word to complement. I don't use art as an alternative or replacement. I think it complements and it allows us to examine the same topics, especially these sensitive, complicated topics, with more freedom, with less tension maybe, and also with the insistence of the use of imagination and creativity.
That was so uplifting. While pointing out the complexity of truth-seeking and multivocality, you also showed us how artistic practices can help to refine our thinking. Thanks so much for sharing your insights. and we wish you loads of inspiration for your writings.
Thank you very much for having me.
We did a deep dive into truth seeking in Syria in this episode. I'm sure that you could go on about informal truth practices, but I suggest we leave it here.
Sure, and I was really happy, by the way, to invoke the imagination and to have the pleasure to involve speakers who demonstrate that the work of the imagination is essential to truth seeking and that arts can be part of justice.
I want to thank also our guests, Sima Nassar, Leila Kiki, and Mohammed Al-Attar, and also our voiceover, Maisa Tanjour. And before we leave, can you tell our listeners a bit more about the next episode?
We will explore victims' activism and particularly zoom in on the truth and justice charter and the mechanism for the missing and the disappeared.
Thank you to our listeners and stay tuned for the next episode. Bye, Brigitte.
Bye, Artino. Thanks a lot.
This was Justice Visions. To re-listen to this episode or to browse our archive, visit our website, justicevisions.org, or subscribe now via Spotify or Apple Music. Justice Visions is made possible through generous funding of the European Research Council.